Hi, Mark. Well, there's one person in here that knows me as a little Marky P.
Marky P.
From Donnie and I go way back to about 1981. But anyway, I'm Mark P, and I'm an alcoholic and a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I'm really nervous. And when I was in high school and I played football, I'd get so nervous I'd never want to play. And I'd get in the game, and as soon as I made a tackle, I was fine. So if I could tackle somebody, I would feel a lot better. When I asked Paul, who's the Al-Anon speaker? And he goes, I don't know. And I walk in the room and I see Dave with a suit on and I go, oh shit. He's either coming home from church or he's gonna be the Al-Anon speaker. So I had to go back and put on my best Jerry Garcia shirt. So that, anyway, it's an honor to be here. I have been an Al-Anon speaker, I've been an AA speaker, but I've never done both, so this is going to be really interesting. I tried to sit up last night and write notes, and they're just scribble. I can never been able to talk off notes. And one time I was asked to speak at church at the different masses, and they would have me write the whole thing down and so they could approve it, and then they'd give it to the Hispanic people, and they would translate it, and whatever was on the paper was not what I said. And the Hispanic people were like, what if, it's all up here. Anyway, I'm very glad to be here. I've wanted to come to this retreat for a long, long time. Every year, Bill Parks would invite me, and every year I'd be up in the mountains building igloos with Boy Scouts, at least for the last 20 years. And I really enjoyed doing it. And last August, I told the Boy Scouts, I am going to this retreat and I'm taking a year off. And I picked the right year because from what I understand, it rained on them all weekend up at Stevens Pass, and I was in a nice cozy room. Anyway, so my story. I grew up Catholic Irish family up on Capitol Hill in Seattle. I was the middle of 10 kids, and my dad was a physician down at Group Health Hospital, and he was a drug addict and an alcoholic. He had about a 30 or 40 year addiction to narcotics. And trying to describe what it was like, when the movie The Shining came out with Jack Nicholson, I asked all my siblings, all nine of them, what does that remind you of? And they go, that was dad. That was dad to a T. He was fine if he drank, and he was fine if he just did drugs, but when he mixed them together at holidays, you know, Christmas, whatever, vacation, he just became a very diabolical and evil person. And I grew up scared to death. I was probably the smallest out of all my brothers and sisters. And the only good thing about our house up on Capitol Hill was it was huge. You know, nobody wanted those houses but big Catholic families. And we had two stairways, you know, front stairway, back stairway, so you could always stay ahead of my dad when he was coming after us. And I, being the smallest, I could hide in the tiniest cabinets in our house. I could get into the powder room and get into that bathroom vanity and shut the door behind me. I could get in the little corner kitchen cabinet, you know, and I would hear my father walking. It was kind of like, you know, and I would stop breathing. You know, he at some point he watched that TV show Sea Hunt and decided he wanted to be a scuba diver. And he got a spear gun, and middle of the night he liked to shoot it off. And it'd be through the TV set. One night he came up to my bedroom and he shot it through my closet door about 6 inches from my head. And I just got invisible. And like I said, I was scared to death. I love my father and I hated my father. I said, I will never drink and I will never hit a woman. And I can remember one time, he was a ham radio operator and he was climbed up on the roof of our house. That's like 60 feet above the ground, messing around with his antenna. And my mom has us down in the living room all praying the rosary. And I'm praying that my father will fall off the roof. I'm not kidding, I was praying. And I felt so bad about that for a long time until I found out that we were all praying that he would fall off the roof. And, you know, growing up, I was raised Catholic. I wanted to be a priest. I wanted to be like my uncle, who was a Jesuit priest over at Seattle U. And all my memories of growing up are with him. He would come grab my sister and me or any of my siblings and take us to Seattle U basketball games or the zoo or whatever. I spent a lot of time with him, and I wanted to be just like him. And, you know, by the time I was 14, the summer of 1970, everything changed. My brother, older brother, had gone off to the priesthood, and I wanted to follow and be a Maryknoll missionary. And but the summer of 1970, right before my freshman year, I was going to go down, like my brothers, down to Seattle Prep. I went down to the Harvard exit. You know, for 50 cents, I'd go to a movie, and I did it all the time by myself. And I saw the movie Woodstock. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever seen full frontal nudity. And my desire to be a priest immediately went away. It was dramatic. I thought, where has this been all my life, you know? And I, shortly after that, I went on a church hike. When I was out with some friends, one was a year older, one was 2 years older, they were already at Seattle Prep, and they bought a six-pack. You know, Tom was 6'2", and Rob was 6'1", and I'm 5'6", and I drank 3 beers that night, and I got that feeling that every alcoholic knows. It was amazing. I was smarter, I was funnier, I was taller. Everything about me was better. And the very next day, I went on a church hike, and I kissed a girl for the first time. That's it. Done deal. I spent the rest of my high school years trying to get drunk as often as I could. And I remember freshman year, one of the kids in my class, we had these little encounter sessions, and we would tell each other what we thought about him. And he said, all you ever talk about is getting drunk. And he couldn't understand it. And I go, yeah, I mean, what else is there to do? And by the time I was a junior in high school, this restaurant, Block's Restaurant, opened on Capitol Hill. And I ended my career at Dick's Drive-In and went over there, and I could drink at night. And I'd come home, walk the 6-7 blocks back to my house, and I'd be drinking wine and beer. And I thought, I'm living the dream, you know? So that promise to my mom I'd never drink, you know, lasted till I was 14. By the time I was a senior in high school, I was drinking every day, and when we went on independent study project, I started drinking in the mornings. My best friend and I would drive up to the Granada grocery store behind Dick's Drive-In on Capitol Hill. We'd buy a case of beer, we'd drink it. And at some point in my senior year, I got arrested for being in a tavern, and they sent me to the Eastside Alcohol Center, and they gave me the 20 questions, and I answered 17 of them yes, because I thought everybody drank like I did. I thought that was normal. I hadn't lost a wife, I hadn't lost a job, and there was something else that I hadn't done, but I had done everything else, including having a blackout. And I just said, well, you guys are full of shit. I'm not an alcoholic. If I'm an alcoholic, my friends are, you know, and they go, they probably are. So by that time, my father was also fallingal apart. He had a grand mal seizure during the middle of surgery up at Group Health, and that was the end of his career. You know, the doctors there, they said, my dad was a walk-in pharmacy. They said he had never met a drug he didn't like. And my mom was in complete denial about it. She would just say, if you kids were quieter, if your father works too much. She had a million reasons on why he was the way he was. I just knew he was an asshole and he was a very scary person. And his last person I wanted to be like. But I was getting into my own alcoholism. And after that, so I had got arrested at 18. They told me I was alcoholic. I got arrested at 19 buying beer at a 7-Eleven. And at 20, when on April 9th, 1976, I was coming home from the J&M Cafe. The Sonics had just clinched their first shot at the playoffs. The Sounders had just played the Cosmos with New York, with Pele on the team. So there's thousands of people in Pioneer Square, and I got really, really drunk. And I tried to drive across the floating bridge in my nice little Camaro convertible, and every time I threw up, I hit the Jersey barrier all the way across. And I got arrested over in front of the Medina Church, and I knew this was serious. And I got a lawyer, went to court, they gave me a deferred prosecution, and they one of the things was you gotta go to AA. That was 1976, and I would go up to the Eastside Alano Club, and then I found out I could sign my own slip, and they would figure it out. So the next 3 years, I had that battle, that am I or aren't I? And I, you know, I was working in the restaurant still, and I was drinking every day. And I kept saying, every night I'd go to bed, am I an alcoholic or not? And finally, in about 1979, I finally quit the restaurant business. And I knew it wasn't working for me. And I got offered a job at Boeing through my roommate. His brother hired me. And I took the job in 79, and I felt like a complete imposter. Like, I'm wearing a suit, and I'm a little kid in this big suit. And this girl that worked with me, we were going to get married, and she dumped me. And I called my sister, who I knew I could get Valium from. She was a nurse. And we went up to the Finney Ridge Cafe, and I'm talking to her about this woman that had dumped me, and has she done me wrong, and can I get some value from her? And right in the middle of talking to her, I said, Betsy, I'm an alcoholic. And I was 23, and she looked at me and said, Mark, I'm an alcoholic too. We were the two most responsible in the family. She was the number five, I was number six. We ran the household. We did everything. My mother was so sick, she lived in her room. My parents had separate rooms. My dad had like an apartment. He never ate dinner with us. He never spent any time with us. I'd bring his food up to him. I'd bring his car around in the morning, point it towards Group Health Hospital so that he could get there. Some days he would come home and I'd say, where's the car? And he'd go, oh shit, I must have walked home. And I have to go find his car. But it was insane, and my sister and I were the two responsible ones. And she goes, what are you gonna do? And I said, all I know to do is go to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because I'd been to those meetings up at the Eastside Alano Club. And so that night I came home and I stopped at Andy's Tavern, I bought a six pack, and I had one beer, and I called my old boss for Block's Restaurant. I said, Barry, I'm an alcoholic and I wanna quit drinking. And he goes, you're the responsible one. And he goes, I don't think you're an alcoholic. I said, no, I really think I am. And I got off the phone, I got on my knees and I prayed. I hadn't prayed since I started drinking. From wanting to be a priest, I just turned my back on God. And I wanted no part of that. And I said, God, I have become my father and I don't want to live. And that was February 9th, 1979. And that was the last time I ever drank or drugged. I woke up the next morning, I was on fire. Instead of waking up the next morning like I would normally do and say, what did I say? Who did I call? Why did I do that? I thought, I want to get sober. I got the Yellow Pages and I looked up the hotline for AA. And they said, there's a meeting down in Fremont at 10 o'clock. You know, and this was, 8 o'clock in the morning. And I went down to Fremont and I couldn't find the meeting, and I went into a bar because down there, they all opened really early. And I just was trying to tell the guy, I said, I'm looking for this place. And he goes, it's up there. I didn't even tell him what it was. And I walked across the street, went up the stairs, and I sat down. They had those huge tables and those huge chairs up at Fremont. And, people like Wino Tom and Boxcar Bill and, Indian Marie and these people that I didn't know then, but I got to know later. And they asked, is there anybody here new? And I kind of went, here, and I said, I'm Mark, I'm an alcoholic. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And they said, you're welcome. Nobody looked at me and said, you're too young to be here. I was 23. And I could remember where I was sitting. It was a rainy Saturday morning. I looked out the window and I could see the Aurora Bridge, and I thought of all the people that used to jump off that bridge. And I worked with a guy at the restaurant that jumped off it and survived it and worked with me, Anyway, so I felt one of the things I noticed immediately when I walked in, I saw the 12 steps, 12 traditions. I saw God everywhere in there. And this incredible sense of relief came over me. I thought, God's going to be here with me. I've been running from him. I've been hiding from him. And now I'm going to be working this program with him. The next day I went to Green Lake. I don't know if anybody remembers Green Lake, but Carl Brown and Toby, man, they were legendary. And then the next day on Monday, my sister wanted to go with me. And I said, let's go to Hilltop. That's where I went. And We went to Hilltop, and it was a lot of laughter. There were Cadillacs in the parking lot. I said, all right, a little bit better than Fremont. And I was off and running, and I lived with three guys I grew up with from, you know, St. Joseph's and Seattle Prep and stuff, and they were not happy that I was sober. You know, I was the organizer, I was their buddy, and it got to be very difficult living in that house, and I had to move out, and then I moved in with my crazy brother, who, you know, drug addict, alcoholic. One time the SWAT team surrounded his place on the east side. I was trying to get a gun from him so he wouldn't kill himself. And nobody in my family could believe, you moved in with Mike? And I go, yeah. And Mike and I had an understanding. I wouldn't get him sober and he wouldn't get me drunk. And people couldn't understand how I could live with my brother back then. And I said, I look at him and it makes me want to go to a meeting. And I go, that's not what I want to be. But he really was kind to me, and it worked out well. So I started going to meetings every night up at the Eastside Alano Club. 7 days a week I'd go to meetings. And one time, in my first year, some young lady who I was kind of attracted to, she said, are you going to the young people's retreat? And I go, yeah, sure, I'm going. And then I looked around to find out where it was, and it was at Pilgrim Furs, and it was the Puget Sound Young People's Council's annual AA retreat. And I went to it, and I made the mistake of bringing somebody, because when I wanted to leave, I couldn't. I had somebody, because I really wanted to leave. I didn't feel part of it. I didn't understand these people that were hugging and kissing each other. I hid out in the ping pong room, and I felt really isolated. And I prayed. And by Sunday morning, I wanted what they had. You know, I wanted to get in the circle. I wanted to be part of it. And I found a sponsor there, and it changed my life. I got really involved with the young people. And I remember going to a meeting over in Medina that first year, and this woman, Pat Stromberg, who was really well known in AA, she was always on TV for the Washington State Council on Alcoholism. She came up to me at a Medina meeting, which was a really big meeting, and she came up to me and said, Mark, we had a business meeting, and you've been elected on the cleanup committee. And I thought, how does that work? This isn't even my home group, and I wasn't at that meeting. And she just looked at me, and she goes, just be in the kitchen, and they'll tell you what to do. And I went in the kitchen, and there was, 5,000 ashtrays? And I had to wash them all. But the cool thing was, I found all the people in the kitchen were like me. We were all scared to death. We didn't know how we were going to live without alcohol. And we had our own little meeting in the kitchen. And I washed a bazillion ashtrays. And after 6 months, I said, Pat, can I do it again? And what I discovered was, they had many people to wash ashtrays. But somebody cared enough and said, if we don't find a job for this kid, he's going to get drunk. And, you know, that was it. So my whole legacy with service started then. I have had a service position in AA for, 46 years? And I've always was not comfortable with that position. My sponsor at the time, no matter what the problem was, would say, who are you working with? So at some point, Milam's opened up over on Pill Hill, it was back when it was called Consolidated Treatment Center, and somebody asked me to come and chair the first meeting they had. And I chaired the first AA meeting they ever had at Milam's. And I had a VW bus, and I started taking people to meetings. And it got to the point where I was taking seven nights a week, I was going to filling my bus full of people and taking them to meetings everywhere. We had somebody gay, we went to the gay meeting. We had, you know, women, we'd go to Residence 12, wherever. We went everywhere. And that was absolutely amazing. At some point in my office at Boeing, there was a guy that walked in. I started at Boeing on February 2nd, 1979, and I got sober 1 week later. This guy came in like a month after I did, and he was 6'5", a super dark tan from being in the Peace Corps in Fiji. dated the most beautiful woman in our office. I hated him. I hated this guy. He was a foot taller than me, and he drove a nice new car, and I would never talk to him. And one Wednesday night, I was at Robinswood over in Bellevue in August of 1980, and who walks in but Jim? And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and it was, what the hell are you doing here? And I said, the same reason you're here. And that was August 1980. He and I have been inseparable ever since. I was telling somebody the other day, there are so many men, not just in AA or out of AA, that don't have a close male friend. You know, I had five brothers, but they didn't have a close male friend. And I said, Jim and I have done everything together. We helped each other stay sober. We both quit Boeing at the same time. I went on to, you know, get into carpentry, go to carpentry school in 83, and he went on to get his master's in work, you know, in finance. And we would talk every day on the phone two or three times. We would do everything together. You know, at some point we got married, and our wife said, what the hell do you guys talk about? And we would laugh our way through sobriety. You know, I was talking about him at lunch the other day, and I picked up my phone, I showed everybody. He's calling me from Tucson, Arizona, where he lives now. And it's just been an absolute blessing to have that man in my life. And then I had my first sponsor I fired because he sponsored too many people and he just didn't have time. So I got this other sponsor, Mel, who was a chief petty officer at a nuke sub in Bangor from Tennessee, has a southern accent, and nobody liked him. So I got him to myself. And Mel was a wonderful sponsor. And he was kind, he was loving. You know, he would see people would say, yo, get a real asshole to be a sponsor. And Mel wasn't that way. And he goes, people get that because that's what they're used to their fathers being like. And it works for them. And I said, I didn't want that. He was very kind and loving. He taught me some incredible principles. First thing he taught me is I'm not a victim. And I would argue with him, and I would say, well, what about this? He goes, no. And he would always tell me, find your place in every one of the situations. And I kept thinking, okay, here's one. And he goes, no, here's where your part is in that. You know, the only time I would think probably not is growing up in an alcoholic family. I didn't choose it, you know. But he also said, you know, that back in the 80s when ACA was really popular, and it was like, I just didn't feel comfortable in an ACA meeting. And he said, yeah, maybe your parents caused it, but it's up to you to fix it. And I felt, I can do that, you know. And over the course of time, I could see that my parents came from screwed up families, you know. And then my dad yanks my mom out of the Midwest and brings her here and gives her 10 kids, and he's a maniac, you know. He's a friggin' drug addict, alcoholic. He would put us in a boat. We'd always go up to Roach Harbor, put us in a boat, and then he would pass out on the Straits of Juan de Fuca with a boat full of kids. The awful part where I started getting my Al-Anon story was, why did my mother let him do that? She never got in the car. She never got in the boat. So, you know, I grew up with so much trauma. I had a realization about a year ago that I couldn't believe it took me so long to figure out, but when I was a kid, you know, there was 10 of us, most of us were bedwetters. Every day, wet the bed, grab your sheets, go down, wow, it was just this routine. And a year ago, I realized I never once wet the bed at a sleepover. And I slept over at people's houses two or three times a month. And I never put two and two together. I only wet the bed at home. You know, I must have been just terrorized, afraid to get out of bed, afraid I'm going to run into my father in the middle of the night. And yeah, I never went to bed. And I thought, wow, I never even dawned on me. So there's a lot of, you know, I wished when I was younger we had gone to Alateen. That would have helped all my siblings and me so much. But, you know, my mother didn't believe in Al-Anon and, you know, whatever. It was what it was. So when I came at AA, nobody in my family had ever gotten sober, all the way back to Ireland. I was the first person to get sober. And from that point on, I said, God never had to do another thing for me, that this was the greatest gift I'd ever been given. And I felt like I've told people many times, the minute I walked into AA was the day I won the lottery. And then my brother Kevin, he in 83, you know, said, listen, I'll read your big book if you read, you know, this Catholic book. He wanted me to come back to the Catholic Church. And I said, okay, I'll read your book, you read my book. And I sent him a big book, and he and his wife got sober in 83. And I read his book 25 years later. And it was a great book. I still have it. And then my little brother came out from Minnesota. He was just crashed and burned in college, partied too hard in the early 80s. And he camped out on my couch, and he needed help. He was a basket case. And I tried everything, tried to get, you know, talk about trying to control it, tried to take him to the right doctor, the right this, the right meeting, the right whatever. And there was a guy at our meeting. You remember Big Ed? Big Ed O'Donnell. He was a big AA circuit speaker, huge guy. And one time he looked at me and he said, Mark, do you believe in God? I said, yes. He's taking good care of me. He goes, why the fuck don't you think he's taking care of your brother? That was the first night I slept without worrying about whether my brother was going to kill himself. And the next day, he got hooked up with my best friend, Jim, that worked with at Boeing. And the rest is history. My little brother's a wildly successful, you know, businessman in the Midwest. Never needed to go to AA after he left Seattle. He's married, has kids, and he's done well. Doesn't seem to have a problem with alcohol. It was just a college thing for him. But after that, my sister Betsy got sober. Then my sister Jane got sober. And then John got sent to AA. Most of us came into AA. And it was amazing, the transformation in our family. And at some point along the line, I was 2 years sober, and they had a surprise birthday party for me. And I remember thinking that if nothing changed in my life, I could be incredibly happy. In 2 years, so many wonderful things had happened to me in my sobriety. And the next day, I met the woman I've been with ever since. And I wasn't looking for her, and it was a blind date through my AA sponsor. And my sponsor was Bill W. And Mel would go out to sea a lot, so I had to have a backup sponsor. And it was Bill W. That's he's 55, 6 years sober now, living in Tucson, still around. But his girlfriend worked downtown at the accounting firm that my future wife worked at. And we got married, and now I slide in a little bit into Al-Anon, because after we dated for a while, I had the red flag. She called me up one day, and she's screaming at me. And I said, calm down, what's the problem? And she goes, you unplugged my freezer. And I'm going, what? Well, apparently she had a freezer on her deck on her condo, and she had it plugged into a light, and there is a light switch, and there's nowhere that it says don't turn the light off. And I got something out of it, and I turned the light switch off. And a week later, she goes out there, and it scared me enough where it drove me to counseling with her. So I said, it was an accident. Why are you screaming at me? I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't know. And you know, later on, it's like, it was your fault. But anyway, but that was a red that was a red flag. That was a red flag. So at some point, 83 or 2 or so, we were going to go on a trip. And she's like, well, what are your intentions? You know? I go, what do you mean? She goes, well, are we like heading down that path to get married? And I kind of went, I don't know, are we? And she goes, yeah, I think we are. Okay, we're getting married. And she was all excited about it. And we planned a big wedding. My friends that owned the restaurant had a beautiful home in Medina. We were going to get married in the backyard. And as we got closer to the wedding, I started having doubts. Because for me at that point, my spiritual life was the most important thing, AA and the spirituality that comes with it. And my wife never talked about things of a spiritual matter, never talked about prayer, never talked about turning it over, none of that stuff. And I thought, could I be married to somebody like that? And 2 weeks before the wedding, I called it off. I prayed about it, I called it off, and she was devastated, embarrassed, all this stuff. And I'd gotten a present from Bill Parks' mom. Your mom great lady. And she said, I said, we called the wedding off, we're not going to get married, and that was that. We broke up, and then we got back together. One of my friends, oh, I missed a part of my story. Terry R., a dear friend in AA, her and Jack were in AA and Al-Anon, and she said, Mark, your spiritual life's enough for both. Don't worry about her spiritual program. That'll take care of itself. But to back up, somewhere in my first year, maybe 1980, Terry had come up to me at a meeting in Medina, that big meeting I'd go to, and she said, Mark, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I go, why? She goes, I've heard your story. You need to go to Al-Anon. And I'm thinking, no, I need to go to AA. And, you know, but the Al-Anon was across the concourse there in the other building. So I went. Sure enough, I think somebody mentioned it yesterday, that blue-haired ladies, they definitely were old enough to be my grandmother. There's no question. And, oh, it's so nice you're here, learning this now. It went right over my head. I didn't understand it. I'm an alcoholic. I need to work on that. But I went to a few meetings, and over the course of those years, I would occasionally pop up in an Al-Anon meeting, but not really getting it. And my life was AA. You know, my life was, I was in AA 24/7, service work, doing everything, held every position in AA, and that's where I wanted to be. I sponsored people, you know, and I watched my family change. And anyway, but back to, you know, my wife and I finally, you know, I quit Boeing. I decided I wanted to work with my hands. I didn't want to wear a suit and tie anymore. And I took a leap in faith, and that caused a lot of stress in our marriage, our relationship, and we ended up breaking up. And that summer, I left the house I lived in. I was going to carpentry school, living up at the mansion where Donnie lived, right about two houses from where I grew up, and had the time of my life. And I was going to carpentry school, and the women that owned the meeting, owned the house, had started an AA meeting at the nudist camp, and they wanted us all to come. It was very interesting. And you get really honest when you're in a meeting with nothing on. And, you know, by the end of the summer, it was fine. I was done with that. Went on my merry way, and I got back together with Trish. And we ended up getting married. Instead of a big wedding, we got married in the courthouse. And it was fine. We moved to Ballard. And I realized I didn't know anything about being a husband. I had nothing. I had bad role models. I didn't know at the time, but she had both bad role models, too. But I didn't know that. And at some point in the first year of our marriage, she was working for the accounting firm downtown, and she came home from a doctor's appointment and said, I have a lump in my breast and I gotta get it checked out. Doctor thinks it's probably nothing. And I go, oh, okay. And the day of her appointment, you know, I'm giving her all my best AA philosophy, you know, I'm praying for you. God doesn't give us anything, you know, everything we worry about doesn't happen, on and on and on. And I went to work, she went to work. When I came home, she was on the couch and she was crying. Fuck. I go, bad news? And she goes, no, everything's fine. I go, why are you crying? And she goes, why didn't you go with me? I felt horrible. Why didn't I know that I should go with my wife to the doctor for a very scary situation? I had no clue. I didn't know what to say. Well, I was going to find out a few years later. So we go on our merry way. We, you know, I'm still struggling to be a husband. I don't know how to do this. I'm still going to lots of AA, doing lots of retreats. I started my own business after working for people in the carpentry. And, you know, if you really want to get close with God, start your own business. I didn't realize how well I had it at Boeing. I was so well taken care of. Everything was automatic deposit and retirement, all this stuff. When I worked for myself, I didn't even have health insurance. You know, first time I tried to cut my thumb off on my table saw, it was like, oh, you don't have insurance. You know, and you just need to put butterfly band-aids on that. And so I prayed a lot. You know, we definitely were really poor. But at some point, my wife had changed her mind, and she said she wanted to have kids. And I didn't say a word. I wanted to make sure she really wanted this. I always loved kids. Always loved kids. I was the best babysitter on Capitol Hill. Everybody wanted me to babysit. Parents had me spend the weekend with their kids, which I don't know if I'd let a boy do that, but they did. And I love babies, I love kids. So before we were trying to have kids, nothing was happening. My sponsor said, Mark, before you become a parent, you need to look at your childhood. He said, I know your childhood. You need to look at it before you become a parent. Are you going to repeat the same damage? And I thought, I don't drink. I can't be like my dad. You know, and he goes, he argued with me, and he wanted me to go to this thing down in California that he and some of my friends had gone to. It's called a Cork Hill. Our friends of ours that run a treatment center in the desert would come up here and do retreats twice a year, and they started this thing, this really intensive workshop. I called it Al-Anon on steroids. And finally I said, enough already, I'll go. And then he said, you gotta buy a Cabbage Patch doll. I go, what? No. So I bought the doll, and that's little Marky, and I had to carry him around. We went down there. It was mostly new people in AA, and there was me at the time. I had 10 years sobriety, and I said, I'm gonna show these people how to do it. You know, I'm gonna be, this is how it's, and they made me go first. And you wrote, man, you wrote, they drew pictures of your childhood. I had like 6 hours to talk about nothing but me. And I was telling them all the stories about how independent I was, how, you know, I would work at Dick's Drive until 3 a.m. and ride my bike all the way from the U District to Capitol Hill, 3 a.m. I'm a big kid, I can do that. And I told them the time that I was in grade school, the 8th grade, and I had to have surgery on my leg. I was at St. Joseph's, got out early for Christmas. I came home, I packed my bag, and I walked to the hospital, and I checked myself in. And I was in the hospital for a week, and one day my dad came down and stuck his head in the room and said, how are you doing, champ? And that was it. Never saw him again. I never thought about it till later, but my dad was a doctor at that hospital, and he was there every day. And I saw him for like 2 seconds, and after a week, I came home, and my sister picked me up and brought me home. And I'm telling this story, and I'm looking out at the room, and people are wiping tears away. I fell apart. And the woman said, Mark, that's one of the saddest stories I've ever heard. And then all of a sudden, it made sense. Of course I wouldn't know to go to the doctor with my wife. Where would I have learned that? And I came home. I uncovered a lot of stuff at that weekend. You know, we did role playing, we did all kinds of stuff. And then I sat down and I wrote a 10-page letter to my mom and not my dad. And all my anger was at my mom. And I didn't understand that. And it was always, how could you let him do this to us? Why did you not protect us? Why did you always put us between you and him? We were like human shields. And I wrote it and I held on to it for about a week and I prayed about it every day. God, do I send this or not? Do I send this or not? And after a week, I sent it to my mom. And I was really afraid I was going to devastate her. You know, they were back in Minnesota. And she came out swinging. And I go, oh, good. Woo. You know, that's my mom, you know, defensive, you know, how dare you? And your father was the addict and alcoholic. And why is everybody on my case? And the minute I sent that letter, I never once had a nightmare about my mother again. I didn't dream about my dad. I dreamed about her, and I would be choking her in my dreams. And I never have had a dream about her in an angry way since then. And I completely let go. The first time my wife and I tried to then get pregnant, we got pregnant. You know, God's perfect timing, right? Got pregnant. My sponsor said, Mark, you're going to find about God's true love. When you have this baby, you're going to know what true love is. And he also told me one of the best things I ever heard. And I've said it a million times to other people, and he said, you get to be the dad you always wanted. And I didn't think about it. Then, you know, my wife went into labor. We went to a little birthing center. She wanted to do it naturally. And my little daughter, Maggie, was born. And I remember it was a cold night across from Northgate Shopping Center. And I went outside, and I just cried. And I looked up, and it was 1 a.m, it was starry out, and I just said, I just met this little girl, and I'd give up my life for her. I go, that's what my sponsor said. That is true love. That changed me. to have that love for that was, it was unbelievable. So then we had three more kids. It was quite an adventure. And I trying to figure out how to be a dad. And I did, I coached their teams. I was the Boy Scout leader, Cub Scout leader. Our house was the house that all the sleepovers were at. Our house was the house that everybody got their bikes fixed at. I never once had a sleepover growing up. I never once had a birthday party. My brother's birthday was on September 13th. My birthday was September 14th. And my big brother's was September 15th. And they just said, what the hell, we're just not gonna do birthdays. And I never had a friend spend the night, which was probably good because I probably would have went to bed and he probably would have seen my father running around in his underwear screaming at people. And I got to do all those things with my kids. And then somewhere along the line, I noticed my wife went from a social drinker to started acting drunk. And then she became an everyday drinker and it started getting worse. And one thing was, right before we got married, my wife told me, if you ever drink, I'm going to leave you. Because she had been married for a very short while, and her husband was drunk on the honeymoon the whole time, and he threatened her with a gun, and she came home from the honeymoon and got her marriage annulled. She said, I'm never going through that again. But it hurt my feelings, because she'd never seen me drink, and I go, okay. And I kept my end of the bargain, but she became an alcoholic. And it was very subtle. She was always out with the women in the PTA. And I think, her drinking was at night. And she still was able to run her business. And I had my business. But I noticed it. And it was starting to get a little bit embarrassing. And my family would start looking at it. But I just went on my merry way. And then in 2001, I'd had enough. I don't have midlife crisis. I don't know if it was 9/11, it just happened, but I thought, is this the way I want to live the rest of my life? And I thought not. And I decided I wanted a divorce. And she made the comment, I thought you would never leave me. And I thought, well, how much abuse did you think I would take? And anyway, I got to back up a second. When we first got married, the reason I'm at this retreat is because I lost a bet 40 years ago. And 40 years ago, we were married in our first year, and it was the night of the NCAA basketball championship. And back then, the Academy Awards were always on the same night as the NCAA. My wife wanted to watch the Academy Awards, and I wanted to watch the NCAA championship. So I was being a smart ass. I said, well, honey, if you can tell me what a Georgetown Hoya is, you can watch the game. I watched the Academy Awards. And she says, I know exactly what a Hoya is because my boss at the office wanted to know, and I called the library, and they told me. And I go, it was Greek for what rock and, whatever. Anyway, she got it. I had to leave. So I called a friend I sponsored. I said, hey, Dave, can I come over and see your new house and watch the game with you? He said, sure. So I pull up in front of his house, and I look over, and I go, oh, my God, I think that's Mimi Parks' house. Russell and Alan's mom and Bill Park's mom's house. And so I went over to visit with her and we had a long talk. She was battling cancer and I asked her a million questions about my father because she knew my father very well. And when it was all over, she said, you need to get to know my son Billy really again. And I go, well, I'm Russell's age, right? Russell, you and I are the same age. And I go, and she goes, Billy's my brother's age. And she goes, no, you and Bill have a lot in common. I said, what? She goes, well, you're both in construction. He converted to Catholicism to marry Beth, and he's in AA. And I thought, oh, wow, cool. And a couple weeks later, I get a call, and it's Bill Parks. He goes, my mom says we got to get together. And so we got together, and that was 40 years ago. And I've been closer to Bill than any of my brothers, to my sponsor, than my father. And he has been that Eskimo we talk about in AA that has saved my life over and over again. Because of Bill, I came back into the Catholic Church. He asked me to come work down at the Neseca retreat house where he did a lot of work, a lot of volunteer work down in Oregon with the Jesuits. And I finally got sick of him bugging me, and I went down. And I worked, and we were celebrating Mass, and I started crying. It was like, it was time for me to come home. My uncle, the Jesuit priest, said, you know, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. And I thought, I sort of believe that. And it was wonderful. And the neat thing was that Bill did it by, like, St. Francis, you know, go out and preach the gospel, and when all else fails, use words. Bill did it with action. Never, ever. My brother Kevin was constantly trying to browbeat me back into the church, and he just drove me farther away from it. And Bill did it by examples. And that was a wonderful thing. Then he got me into hiking and mountain climbing. And then he was there for me every step of the way with my construction business, trying to, every time I had a problem, I could call Bill. He filled that role that maybe a father should have filled, you know? I had no relationship with my dad hardly at all. By the time I was a junior in high school, I made the starting varsity on the football team. I was 5'6", 130 pounds, and we were like the number one team in the state. And I was starting, and my dad never saw me play, never saw me play any sport. Never came to anything. And I never expected him to. So I never felt bad till I became a parent. I never got angry till I started going to Al-Anon. And there was a bumper, I saw a bumper sticker years ago and said, it's never too late to have a happy childhood. And I wanted one that said, it's never too late to have an unhappy childhood, you know. And but Bill became such an incredible, incredible friend for me. And, you know, we don't agree on a lot of things. It hasn't mattered one hoot. All the greatest adventures I've had in my life in the last 40 years were all generated by Bill. When I climbed Mount Rainier, it was a trip he organized. He and all the other guys bailed, but I still got to do it. All the times I, you know, hiked in the Enchantments, it was a Bill organized trip, sponsored by Bill P. Anyway, we did, 2 years ago, we did a 100-mile hike up in the North Cascades. It was absolutely brutal. And it was epic, and it was hard. And I kept saying, I can't do it, I got work. You know, I own my own business, I can't leave it. And he just slowly beat me down. Every single excuse, there was an answer. And I said, what the hell, I'll go. Became one of the greatest adventures I have ever been on. And we're looking forward to the next one. So, but anyway, back to raising kids and my wife. At some point, when I was separated from my wife, I did an inventory. I went down to Niseka with Bill, talked to Father Andy, and I gave him my inventory on why my marriage was over. And he looked at it, and he laughed at me, and he crumpled it up, and he threw it away. And he said, Mark, your problem is not Trish, it's God. He said, if you focus on your relationship with God, all your other relationships will fall into place. I go, okay. I mean, that sort of reminded me of my sponsor saying I'm not a victim, you know. And so I came home. I was still living outside the house, and I immediately saw my own sins. I saw my part in everything in living color. I wasn't seeing my wife as 99%. I had lots of support that my wife was the problem from my whole family, everybody. I saw my part in it. But one of the greatest things was I realized that people kept telling me, you have a right to be happy, right? You have a right to be happy. You deserve to be happy. And I said, I do, but I don't have a right to make my children unhappy. I asked God for all three of those kids, and I love them dearly, Maggie, Henry, and Quinn, and my happiness, to me, maybe you think different, does not supersede theirs. And I decided to move back home, and I did not want to raise my children part-time. I wanted to be a full-time father, and I came back home. My wife had tried to make a few changes. It was tolerable enough, and that was almost 25 years ago, and I have never regretted it for one second, not one second. Today, I have an incredible relationship with all three of my children. They call me every day. Every day, I talk to my kids. My son was in Puerto Rico. He'd call me every day and ask me advice and stuff, and I can't put a price on that. And over the course of time, my son, Henry, when he was 18, I know, when he was 18, his senior year in high school, he got the disease, and he got it bad. He just went from 0 to 60 really fast. You know, went from smoking pot to doing hard drugs in 6 months. And I started going to Al-Anon back then. That was probably 18 years ago. But I wasn't really committed to it. I was trying to work my AA program on him, and not having much success. But finally, cops come into our house all the time, and him lying and cheating, and it's just horrible. It brought me back to my childhood. Henry would slam a door in the basement, and I was 5 years old again, hiding in my closet, from my dad. I heard my dad slam a door, and when Henry would do that, it was right back to being 5 years old again. And we finally, through a lot of things, got him into Sundown Treatment Center, and my wife didn't want to participate. And I went and I stayed there for the 3 days for the family program, and I became an Al-Anoner. That was it. That was in 2009, that's the date I use for my Al-Anon birthday. It was August of 2009. I was all in. I came home, I got a home group, and I got very involved. And Al-Anon started becoming more important to me than AA. I'd still go to AA, but, and then over the course of time, my wife kept, I could see this train wreck was gonna happen. And when I brought my son home from the treatment center, my daughter goes, "Dad, you know mom's an alcoholic?" And I go, "Well, yeah, why do you think she's an alcoholic?" She goes, "Because she drinks every morning." And I didn't know that. And she would go on her merry way, and at some point, I sat in church and I cried one day, and there was a retreat going on at church, and I decided I was going to go, and I went, and it reminded me of my first AA meeting, and all these people were talking, and I realized my faith wasn't what I thought it was. And I made a commitment that day. It was St. Patrick's Day, 2007. And I said, I am going to work my faith the way I worked AA. I did it exactly by the book. I did as my sponsors told me. I didn't do my own version of it. And I'm going to work my Catholic faith exactly the way it's written. And I literally got rocked into the fourth dimension. I got a relationship that I never thought I would have. I found the winners at my church. I hung out with the winners. I did everything they were doing. I wanted what they had. I was there 5 days a week. I started teaching children their catechism. I started doing everything, and the rewards were immense for me. I got a relationship with God that I always wanted. And a few years ago, our parish priest said, "Hey, I got this program back in 2020. That I recommend we do." And it was called Exodus 90, and I read all the things. I said, "This is impossible. We can't do this." But I needed it. I desperately needed it. We quit everything. You quit internet, quit your phone. You just quit everything. If you drink, you don't drink. We don't put cream in our coffee. We fast twice a week. We don't eat between meals. We don't spend money. We pray for an hour. We, on and on and on. We take cold showers every day. And I did it during COVID, and it was the most incredible thing I'd ever done. We were the most chill people you ever saw during COVID. I lost 35 pounds from not eating, no sugar, no snacking, fast twice a week, and it was amazing. And I said, I'll never do it again, and I've done it 6 straight years. And the whole point is, it's to take away the distractions. I am the king of distractions. I'm watching a movie while I'm playing a game, while I'm reading a book, while I got my earbuds in, listening to music. I had to get quiet if I wanted to hear God's voice. They recommended a book by this African cardinal, Cardinal Seurat, called The Power of Silence. And I read it, and it said, God's in the silence. And it was just a remarkable book. And the gifts I've gotten from this, every time I go through the kitchen there, I see all those snacks, I don't touch them. I want to look at the internet and find out what's going on in the world. I want to renew my addiction to Netflix, on and on, but I haven't. I've learned how to get quiet. I learned how to get in my car and keep the radio off. I learned how to, God, what is it? I carry my rosary beads wherever I go, because when I'm in traffic, they calm me down. I pray the rosary instead of yelling at people. All this has gotten me ready for 3 weeks ago, what I had dreaded happened. I took my wife to the doctor against her will. And she was in there all day, and she would not let me talk to her doctors. And everywhere I went, I said, she's an alcoholic, she's gonna lie to you. And finally, 4 days later, I came to pick her up. We couldn't find her because she wouldn't let anybody know she was there. And I grabbed her discharge papers, and she said, that's mine. And I looked at it, and it says cirrhosis of the liver. I knew it was coming. My son's a paramedic. He looked at her chart and said, Dad, they removed 5 liters of fluid from her abdomen. That's a record. I got her home. I asked her, why you don't let me look at your medical records? She goes, I don't trust you. And I didn't know what to say. I thought, okay, my marriage is over. You know, we celebrated 40 years of marriage last April, and we had a good time. And I just turned it over to God. I said, God, you're in charge. My kids are saying, why do you stay with her? And on our 30th wedding anniversary, because I asked her to do it, she's not Catholic, my kids aren't Catholic, I said, I want a sacramental marriage. And we got married in the church. And because I did, I saw my wife in living color and not black and white anymore. I saw all of her and not just the alcoholic. And I thought, you know, sickness and in health, it is a disease. And I don't know where it's going to go. I just know that God's in charge. She's really got a lot of health problems. You know, she's really, really sick. And she has, you know, she wanted me to come to the retreat. And my son's there taking care of her. And I don't know what the future holds, but I know that God gives me a gift, and everything that's ever happened to me, I've had a gift. And the gift in this one right off the bat was all my kids banded together with this one. And they wouldn't do that in the past. All 4 of us are working together to try to help her. I'm really confused on how to react to her. I completely ignored Valentine's Day this year, refused to acknowledge it for the first time in 44 years with her. I thought it would be disingenuous if I tried to pretend. But I am committed. And I know I dropped my AA group on Friday nights after 10 years because I wanted to put another Al-Anon meeting in. My Al-Anon friends have been so supportive. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I pray every morning for her. Part of my Exodus 90 thing is something, I'm doing something I never thought I could do, but for the last 6 years, I get up every morning at 4 and I pray for an hour. It's the best part of my day. It's the part that I absolutely look forward to. I never need to set an alarm. I just pop up, I go down, cup of coffee, light a candle, pray, meditate, rosary beads, and I'm ready to handle the stuff that happens to me. You know, in that time, my daughter got pregnant her senior year of college, my son came home transgender, my other son needed to go back to treatment, and God got me through every single one of those. I have been blessed beyond my wildest dreams in AA. My extended family is sober. My grandkids, the nephews and nieces are sober. I have a wonderful relationship with all 7 of my grandkids. They FaceTime me all the time. I am blessed beyond relief. So when people say, how do you handle all this? I go, my triangle is AA, Al-Anon, my faith. I need all 3 of those. Without them, I don't have a chance. I am so glad to be here this weekend. I have met so many incredible people. I know God loves me to pieces when I come to things like this. So that's it. Thank you very much.